Support for WGTD's morning show comes from the generosity of the family and friends of the late Frank and Beverly Falduto, two lifelong Kenoshans who devoted much of their lives to the community in general and to WGTD in particular. Mr. Falduto played an essential role in creating WGTD nearly 40 years ago and later served as station manager and occasional morning show co-host. And we welcome you to the Monday morning show on WGTD HD. Kenosha, Racine, Elkhorn, and Lake Geneva, your gateway to public radio. I'm Gregory Berg. I am delighted to welcome a faculty colleague back to the morning show today, Wayne Thompson, Associate Professor of Sociology. Professor Thompson specializes in examining the place of religion in the lives of Americans, the influence that religious practice has on other spheres of our life together, and some of the ways in which religion is playing quite an important role in this current hotly contested presidential race. We're going to be talking about a whole lot of different things. Before we get into our conversation, we do want to remind you that this is the last day of the pledge drive of Wisconsin Public Radio. We're going to have an uninterrupted conversation until 9 o'clock with no talk of bandanas or other matters related to the fundraiser. But it's important if you do listen to WGTD, and especially if you are a listener to the morning show, it would be great if you would take a moment to express your appreciation for what you enjoy over WGTD and Wisconsin Public Radio with a financial pledge. You can do so toll-free 1-888-202-2552, again 1-888-202-2552, or you can go to their website, wpr.org, wpr.org. It takes just a moment of your time. They actually do it very, very efficiently, And when you do so, please mention WGTD, and if you're a fan of the morning show, make sure you mention that as well. And thank you for your support for what we do. Again, I'm so happy to welcome into our studios today Wayne Thompson, Associate Professor of Sociology. Professor Thompson has joined us on several previous occasions, but it's been way too long. And I especially feel badly that I haven't had him on because, actually, if you listen to the Ideas Network, you hear Professor Thompson all the time. He's a very frequent guest on Joy Cardine's program and also from a number of times has been a guest on Central Time, which is heard in the afternoon. So it's just been foolish on our part to not access Professor Thompson's expertise on a much more regular basis. So we're really glad to have him here. Professor Thompson, we welcome you back to the morning show.
Thank you, Greg, and thanks to all the wonderful listeners. I'm often in the audience listening to the morning show. It's a beacon of light in the community, and everybody get out and make those pledges. Keep Wisconsin Public Radio and WGTD strong in our community.
Very good. Thank you for saying so. I have to make a confession to you, and that is that when I went to Luther College many, 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 many years ago, without question, my least favorite course in those 4 years was Introduction to Sociology. And I don't think it, I think it had something to do with a fairly ineffective, although well-meaning teacher, but I just found it to be a real hard slog. It felt like it was just talking about a lot of obvious things and just, you know, attaching fairly meaningless names to things we already all knew. And I know the field of sociology is so much more fascinating than that. And just, I don't have to chat with you very long to get a sense of that. That is just an endlessly fascinating arena. But I feel like in some respects, I have yet to fully experience it. And I think a lot of our listeners as well probably have a fairly nebulous notion of what the academic field of sociology, in fact, entails. I wonder if we could just begin there, probably fairly briefly, because we have a lot we want to get to. But
sure. Hopefully get you up into the B or A range on your sociological knowledge this morning, Greg. Sociology is a really interesting subject, but indeed it has been said that sociology is restating the obvious, which you just pointed out. But it's often things that have a taken-for-granted nature. So they need to be said. Sometimes the obvious needs to be restated. Sociology is about how everything connects to everything else, maybe not on the level of, say, philosophy or even anthropology. But sociology is really the study of groups and the influence of groups on individuals. That's a kind of nutshell, and I just love sociology. It's a lot of fun. My particular expertise is within sociology of religion especially the study of congregations.
Hmm. How did you get interested in sociology in the first place? How did it end up being the academic discipline you chose?
Well, I was looking for a work-study job, and I walked down the hallway while I was in college, and the professor that was looking to hire somebody, a history professor, wasn't there, and I knocked on a sociology professor's door, and he said, hey, kid, step in, sit in the seat, now let's go to work. That's kind of what happened.
Wow.
Got hired as a research assistant, and I've been hooked ever since.
And you've been doing this quite a long time. Give us some sense of the kind of studies that you have done over the years, but particularly those that have involved religious practice here in the United States.
Why, sure. I went to the University of Arizona for my master's degree and had the good fortune to be mentored by a Roman Catholic priest, Father Andrew M. Greeley, who was a very well-known priest. He used to write a column in the Chicago Sun-Times. And he really got me hooked on sociology of religion and encouraged me to go back east, or down east, as they say, to University of Connecticut for my doctorate. So I got my master's at Arizona, PhD at University of Connecticut, and studying with some of Father Greeley's friends who introduced me to some bishops and Catholic hierarchy folks who needed pollsters. And so I worked as a pollster for various denominations for about 5 years before becoming a professor. So some of the studies that we do for, you know, that a bishop would be interested in would be regular polling of members, looking at membership declines. And when I worked for the mainline Protestants, looking at diversity issues when I worked for the Catholics, as the Roman Catholic population is very diverse. So studies along those lines, institutional kinds of questions. And then I've been an academic now for many years. I've been at Carthage College. I'm in my 18th year now. And much of my research continues to be on congregations and religion as the average person experiences it, influencing their lives in the context of today's discussion, for instance, religion and politics. I also did a very large-scale study in 2007 through 2010 on Catholic school enrollment in Kenosha and then back in my hometown in Marshfield, Wisconsin, and we surveyed over 4,000 Catholics in the Kenosha study, asking them about decisions for school, whether they decide for Catholic school or public school, keeping the kids in the public or Catholic schools, that kind of theme, including 300 Spanish language questionnaires we did at St. Mark's, which is south on Sheridan Road. So that kind of research is very exciting. The students at Carthage are always involved in helping me collect the data. More lately, I've been talking to Lutheran and Presbyterian parish pastors, a few bishops, leaders, as far as relating to a schism over the issue of homosexual clergy. And so there's always research is like streetcars, Greg. There's always another study coming along.
Mm. And the task is never complete, that's for sure. We hear a lot about how political polling has become much more difficult and much more expensive to do. I mean, in part because there just aren't as many people, not nearly so many people, who are sitting by their rotary phone with the wire connected, waiting for it to ring so they can answer a pollster's questions. It has become more and more difficult to connect with people along the channels that traditionally have been used for decades. Has that made what you do difficult as well? Or do you conduct your polls in a different way than the typical political pollster does?
Well, one always finds ways. And I often revert back to old-fashioned methods of gathering polls because that's what's called for in the situation. The Catholic school study, for instance, involved a component where we interviewed, or I should say had questionnaires, short questionnaire for parishioners as they left Mass. And when Sister Bertina at Holy Rosary is standing in the back collecting these, you have to fill it out.
Okay, mm. So
the response rate goes way up. Another thing that helps when you study religion is that people are very interested in the topic. And if you're studying church members, parish clergy, those kinds of populations, you do get higher response rates. People are highly motivated. They care about the issue. And when I worked for the churches, that was sometimes their employer contacting them for information. So it is a little bit easier. But in general, polling has become very difficult. the margins of error are a problem. Finding young people with cell phones, that's difficult. Now everybody's got a cell phone. So polling has had to adapt to that situation. Oftentimes what you're doing is getting about 1,500 people out of a nation of 300 million. That can be a little bit of a needle in a haystack. But pollsters have their methods. Thank goodness for Dr. George Gallup, who developed the concept of getting representative samples pursuant to some, in 1936, for instance, where Alf Landon, I think, was expected to win in a landslide and didn't for president. And we really did need to develop better polling methods. And so while there are always challenges, polling is here to stay. As soon as we had human groups that had more than 20 people in them, polling was going to be inevitable. And the number 20 is because five fingers on each hand, five toes on each foot, 20. And when we couldn't count on our fingers and toes, polling was on the way.
Very good. One of the things that is, of course, intriguing about the work that you do is the formation of questions. I suppose in some cases, the precise wording of a question might not matter all that much. And then there's other times in which the way a question is phrased can make all the difference in the world in terms of the way a given person might perhaps respond. Can you just say a quick word about that, particularly when we're talking about maybe some of the highly charged issues and questions that, for instance, involve one's religious beliefs and so on? What is the sort of care you have to take in the formation of questions? What are sort of some of the principles which guide you?
Well, questions that used to make sense for the American population may no longer make sense. They lose their relevancy. Certainly measuring racial prejudice has changed because race prejudice has become a much more coded, there are buzzwords involved and so on. And so it goes with many contentious issues. The issue of abortion, for instance, it really does matter how you ask the question. If you ask the general question, do you believe a woman has a right to do with her body as she pleases with regard to abortion under any circumstances, only about 40% of Americans, a little bit over 40% now, would say yes. But if you start to vary the reasons, you say, what about chance of birth defect? What about rape, incest, and other contingencies? Indeed, the percentages go up to as high as 85%. Hmm. So it does matter how you ask questions. Religion, of course, is the messiest of human subject matter. And, of course, that reflects in surveys. It's very difficult to forge meaningful questions about religion that you can witness this, too, just sitting at the Thanksgiving table and listening to families argue. Politics and religion are hard, so polling about politics and religion is also very difficult.
Right. And I should think that, for instance, when you get to something like attitudes about gays, and that if you are posing questions to somebody, let's say a rather conservative person from small town America, they might have feelings that have maybe evolved a bit over the last few years, and yet they still are not fully comfortable in accepting gays the way other people might be. But that doesn't necessarily mean they think they're going to hell, or it doesn't mean they shouldn't be a school teacher or whatever it might be. But they feel some confliction within themselves. And yes. And I suppose your challenge is to pose questions which allow somebody to express those kind of complicated feelings.
Well, and it is. And oftentimes what we're looking for on contentious, culturally contested issues, including attitudes about homosexuals, is a distinction between how people feel about civil liberties and how people feel about the behaviors involved. So homosexuality is a really interesting area to try to poll about. When you ask whether a homosexual or a communist or some other group that may be somewhat marginalized, when you ask whether their book should be in the library, whether they should be a teacher at the public schools, whether they should be able to give a speech in the public domain, those attitudes generally, even for conservatives, are more favorable, right? That there should be more tolerant, I should say. When you ask about the behavior itself, anything related to sex, that's where the cultural fault lines or divisions occur. And even with young people, we hear so much about how the millennial generation is so much more tolerant than the older cohorts regarding gays. Well, there's still a yuck factor, is what pollsters call it at our conventions, with regard to the sex. But when you start to ask about civil liberties, then many conservatives seem much more tolerant. So it does matter how you ask the question. And I always think the best thing, Greg, is to sit down and just talk to people. Go to them in their natural environment. Talk to them. Learn how they map the territory out. And then think about what kind of survey questions would make sense.
So do the talking before you pose the question, in other words. I mean, have some of these conversations ahead of actually constructing the questions and posing the questions.
From a scientific point of view, you get greater validity. But I grew up in a small town farming community in north central Wisconsin, and I learned that the best thing is to talk to people, walk a little bit in their moccasins, and then think about what to ask them in a survey.
For those of you just joining us, I'm speaking today with Wayne Thompson, who is Associate Professor of Sociology at Carthage College. And he is someone who has extensively studied the place of religion in American life and the various beliefs and practices of people who consider themselves religious, and how some of that breaks down in terms of liberals versus conservatives and Democrats versus Republicans. And, of course, this ultimately will lead us into a conversation about the way in which religion is playing some role in this current presidential race. Professor Thompson, one of the things we hear so much about, even before we get to the specific matter of religion, is how America seems like such a divided country at the moment, very much polarized, left-wing, right-wing, in a way. I mean, sometimes to hear it said, you know, we've never been so polarized before. I think most people who have a little bit more thorough historical perspective are careful not to say such things, that we've been in a divisive state of being at many points, maybe most points in our history. Is that your perspective as well, or is there something distinctive about just how divisive we are right now, how divided we are right now?
Yes, well, it's difficult to tell. I'm an empirical social scientist. I like to look at the data on that. But, you know, public opinion polls only take us back to the 1930s. I think about the early 20th century, though, there was a lot of contention at that time about what was called the social gospel. And that was the time in 1910, a group of folks, evangelical Protestants in Southern California especially, developed something called the fundamentals, and thus the term fundamentalist. Now, that doesn't mean that fundamentalists didn't exist in the past. We have no way of knowing, because we didn't have public opinion polls. The village atheist, for instance, may have been present throughout all through the Middle Ages, when we assume people were highly religious, society was fecund with religion everywhere. Well, we have no way of knowing that for sure. I can tell you, though, that the current state that we're in of polarization is the most divisive, probably, that I think since the Civil Rights era and the Vietnam era. That is somewhat anecdotal and somewhat based on data as well. After the 1930s, the New Deal was hotly contested. But American religious culture was a little bit more homogenous, I think, than it is now. I remember in the 1950s, Dwight Eisenhower saying, it doesn't matter where you pray, but that you pray. And the family that prays together stays together. I remember seeing those commercials as a child growing up in the 1960s. And so there is a normative expectation of religion and religious involvement. And I think what's changed is the religious involvement part for young people. Don't feel moral authority of the denominational bodies that they grew up in. So there is some disaffiliation going on there. As far as belief, though, there hasn't been that much change. In the 1970s, about 80 to 85% of Americans believed in life after death. Most people prayed daily. We still have that situation, even among millennials. So what we have is behavior changing, not necessarily belief. In a fast-changing cultural environment, it becomes a juggling act to sort all of this out, of course.
Right. How about the very basic notion of there is a God or there isn't a God? I guess it's the question of whether how many Americans are atheists? Has that number dramatically grown in recent years, as far as you can tell?
Well, the term atheist means different things to different people, of course, and can encompass a wide range from agnosticism to various kinds of atheists. Bernie Sanders, for instance, is Jewish in terms of his religio-ethnic identity, but espouses a kind of quasi-atheism, which I think varies from the kind of atheism you might hear in the crowd at an Occupy Wall Street meeting, right? And so which atheism will the real atheism stand up? That said, there is an increase in atheism, people checking the atheist box in surveys, but it has gone from 1% to 2%, so it's still very small. About 2 to 3% of Americans will check the atheist box if given a chance in a survey. Another 3 to 7%, depending on how you ask the question, will check the agnostic box. That is to say, well, I'm not sure. Okay. And you wonder if some of the agnostics are maybe leaning more atheist, but because of the normative climate in the U.S., you don't want to quite say it's a little safer to say they're atheists. And there are many people who sit in the pews in their churches, in the Methodist and Lutheran and every other denomination, Catholics as well, who have doubt. As I said earlier, there's no reason to believe that the village atheist is anything new with us. It's just that now we have public opinion polls. So is there a real increase in atheism? A certain amount of religious doubt is normal, and I would argue very healthy for us to be asking those kinds of questions. We also know that a faith life based in stronger beliefs is also a very healthy thing. It's good for communities. It's good for the individual. We have lower suicide rates among the religious. So atheism is an interesting topic, but very difficult to actually measure and define because it means different things to different people.
Right. And, of course, I suppose another way to look at this, too, and I don't know how much you have explored this, is the notion of God being an all-powerful being who regularly intervenes in our lives on a very individual, personal level, that it is God who gives us cancer or cures us of our cancer and helps us find a job and helps us find a spouse and so on, versus thinking of God as perhaps an omnipotent being, but one, in a sense, a bit more distant from the everyday workings of our lives, who doesn't give us cancer or cure our cancer, but is maybe present in other ways, but not that sort of an active force. Now, is that more the purview of someone who's more of a religious scholar versus a sociological scholar, or are you in the business of even exploring a question like that?
Sure. What are the images of God? My mentor, Father Andrew Greeley, introduced into the General Social Survey in the as early as the 1970s some questions about how people image God on a kind of pre-thought level, on a more of a feeling and an image level, and found out that Protestants are more likely, especially evangelical Protestants, more likely to have those traditional masculine images of God. Catholics, on the other hand, were more likely to have Father Greeley calls an analogical religious imagination, which is to say to see God in everyday life. So Catholics were, for instance, more likely to than Protestants to say that God is they experience God on the first day of spring when the warm air is coming through and you're waiting for a bus out on Michigan Avenue in front of the Art Institute. A little girl and her dad get off the bus, and the little girl looks up and smiles at you. This is Father Greeley's story, actually, and he says that's God. Well, that's more Catholic kind of religious imagination where God is more imminent in everyday life, less so the other. The Calvinists, you know, back in the 1600s, as that tradition developed, and here we would associate that with Reformed Protestants, Methodists kind of at the outside, Baptists certainly, the evangelical Protestants, the image of God is more traditionally masculine, more a judge, less a liberator, less a friend, but also the friend image, I think, is in the non-denominational churches, the dominant image is Jesus is my friend. I remember an Episcopalian priest, I think Malcolm Boyd, I think was his name, who wrote a book, Are You Running With Me, Jesus?, back in the 1960s, where it's the first thing I read in seventh grade about Jesus sort of being with us in our everyday lives, as opposed to being somebody who's out there, who's other. With my traditional Lutheran background, God was a guy on a cloud judging us and throwing thunderbolts down at us.
I remember, still remember so vividly the day in Sunday school class when one of my classmates, this is probably second grade or something, but one of my classmates, Jackie Barr, when we were talking about God, said, I always think God is like this guy sitting in front of this control panel with a bunch of buttons, and he's pressing these buttons to, you know, make it rain or make it snow or whatever. And that was exactly what my picture was of God. And I remember thinking, that this is so amazing. I thought I was the only person who had this crazy image of
well,
who God is.
We can study that. You know, so social scientists do study that. In 1902, William James, for whom the psychology building at Harvard University is named. So if you go to Harvard, you'll see the William James building. And he was the brother of the famous novelist, Henry James, his more famous brother.
Yeah.
But William James said that religious experience can be studied with all the objectivity of science. And even in the 1970s and 80s, when I first encountered that, I thought, how could that be? Because this is a subjective, right? It's a subjective thing. Nobody can know another person's experience. But indeed, you can see the changes that come in people's lives. And it may be ineffable, difficult to talk about, but people do try to describe their beliefs, their experiences, their images of God. And those things can be studied. Whether God is actually up there in the sky or wherever God lives, if there is a God, the social scientists can't help you with that. So there is a limit there. I would have to toss the beach ball of inquiry back on down the beach to the theologians when it comes to whether God really is up in heaven, laughing with us, laughing at us, running with us in our daily lives, or however that really happens. So there's a limit to where social scientists can bring you on that topic.
Right. We're speaking with Wayne Thompson, Associate Professor of Sociology. We're talking about the place of religion in American life, and we're about to get to the matter of how religion is playing into this very hotly contested presidential race that we're all witnessing right now and to some extent participating in. You've done some very, very interesting work on exploring some of the ways in which there is a divide in America along religious grounds when it comes to, for instance, liberals and conservatives, even before we get to those who identify as strongly Democratic or strongly Republican or moderates in the middle, in terms of sort of the way in which those sort of folks are tend to see something like religion in their own lives. You spelled out quite a lot of interesting data. One of my reactions to it was how there are distinct differences, but on the other hand, in some ways, I expected the differences to be even wider, at least in certain cases. That, you know, for instance, the percentage of liberals who say they pray every day, you know, was frankly a little higher than I thought it might be. Why don't you just talk a little bit about some of what you found from your polling of liberals and conservatives, and what, if anything, was a surprise to you? Or what you think is most significant?
Yes. What I did in preparation for today, for the listeners, a little treat. Instead of just going to doing some Google searches and so on, and what are the latest polls and checking the Pew Forum, I actually bring up the spreadsheet and right here in Kenosha and crunch the numbers myself. So using the General Social Surveys, which is the most used data set to study Americans, I divided liberals and conservatives, combining slightly liberal and extremely liberal, and doing the same thing with the conservatives. So there's some groups combined. But indeed, we find that that religious practice and commitment is lower among liberals, but not at all non-existent. And when you come to the issue of religious belief, the differences are much more muted. For instance, belief in an afterlife, conservatives, 87%. Liberals, though, 76%. Percent reborn experience, conservatives, 49%. Liberals, 28%. Percent pray daily or more often, 68% conservative, 49% liberal. There are differences. The conservatives are more religiously committed and more traditionally religious. But as Barack Obama pointed out in a speech a number of years ago, those of us in blue states or that live in more of a blue world, a more liberal world, do worship God as well. Some do, and some don't. And the notion that there are no atheists among Republicans or conservatives, I think, is probably an overstatement as well.
Hmm. When you pose questions about this, are there... We've already touched on the fact that there are sometimes gradations, and also sometimes people might be inclined to check a box or say, yes, I pray, because in your words, that is still regarded to some extent as normative.
Yes.
I mean, people don't look at you. I mean, some people might, but generally speaking, we feel like someone's not going to look at you strangely or think less of you if you say, oh, yeah, I pray every day. I mean, that's typically not something someone is reluctant to admit. That being said, it sounds like sometimes there are other things going on that might lead somebody to say, oh, yes, I pray every day, when in fact that might not be true. How
religion
do we make sense?
Is seen as a private matter in our culture. And this is something that's recent. In just the last 200 years, religion has moved more and more toward the realm of the private, which brings religion into close affinity with the family. Family is another institution that's also become seen as sort of a preparation, a place where you can go, a place of safety where you can go and be your real self, be your true self, and prepare for the big performance, which is in the economic realm. So what's happened in the last 200 years, certainly, and really since the Enlightenment, has been that economics has become the ascendant realm, the ascendant institution. Religion has declined somewhat. In the Middle Ages, the Pope could tell Charlemagne what to do, and Charlemagne had to do it.
Mm.
The tables are reversed now. Religion still has moral authority, but the moral authority has been collapsing, especially among baby boomers and younger. They do not look to religion for moral authority anymore. And religion being a largely private matter, many people have difficulty taking advice even from the person in the pulpit. Hmm. Because of this collapse of moral authority and the ascendance of individualism, people talk about a personal relationship with God. They talk about what they do want to hear from religion. When they do get involved in organized religion, is how to raise their kids, how to keep their kids off of drugs, how to keep their kids from running out and having sex, or having sex that's unapproved kinds of sex. So in the private realm, regarding what religion still has influence over, the Catholic bishops call it the pelvic issues.
Hmm.
It's, right? So that the idea here is that if society is becoming more secularized, it's difficult to notice that. But if you're claiming that the secularization is really a loss of moral influence of religious institutions, I certainly do see that.
One of the things that you mentioned in some of these statistics you put together is a big difference between urban areas and rural areas. And you come up with a term that I think is quite intriguing called the conservative moral ecology.
Yes.
In small and rural communities. First of all, in small and rural communities, you certainly find some liberal people, but mm-hmm. but obviously they tend to be much more a conservative population. And I'm curious about a couple of things. To what extent is that true? But secondly, do we see between, for instance, the conservatives who predominate in, a small town in Iowa versus the conservatives we might find in a more pluralistic place like an urban like the Twin Cities, is the way they are conservative, live out their conservatism, is that vastly different?
Well, there's a great leveler out there, and it is media and telecommunications has really closed that space. But there is a growing tribalism in American society, and religion runs right down through the middle of that. Hmm. Indeed, conservatives in small towns are more likely to be surrounded by other people who think like them. In other words, when you go to church in a small town, relatively speaking, it is somewhat of an echo chamber. Hmm. And in small towns, I grew up in a small town, you grew up in a small town, there really are only two social venues once you're an adult. Schools, of course, for when you're younger, but taverns and churches. So if you grew up in a small town, you know, those are the venues. And indeed, when you're around other people who think like you, who experienced in the small towns, they experience loss, population loss, brain drain, young people moving away. There is a sense of loss and mourning that is just overwhelming. And I think it does drive a kind of conservative zeitgeist of spirit that it is much more uniformly shared. When you add in the modern telecommunications, you get some urban counterparts to this too. But in the urban area, you're confronted with cultural pluralism in a way that you are not in the rural areas. But even in the rural areas, they are changing. Places like Dodge City, Kansas now have immigrant populations, and they have Muslims. Postville, Iowa, we were talking about before the show, with Orthodox Jews in the meatpacking industry employing Muslims, Mexican immigrants. So there is cultural pluralism slowly getting into the rural and small-town communities. The people there who trace their backgrounds to those areas, who have a sense of place, a sense of connection to those towns, they feel that sense of loss and mourning that their world is being taken away from them. Churches are a place where you can go in those communities and hear, relatively speaking, an echo chamber. Think about the sermons that are heard repeatedly, the cross, the death, the loss. These are metaphors for small-town decline, not only religious metaphors, but they resonate with the everyday experiences of people who are losing their farms, seeing their kids move away. And then the other theme, resurrection, which is the positive side of it. Everything is changing. Not only are urban areas changing and millennials carrying change, everything is changing. Small towns are changing in America. And with that, there are possibilities for new people and new relationships and new connections that I think might be the way through this impasse of tribalism in our culture. It's more likely to happen in urban areas where there is more cultural pluralism, but it is coming to smaller rural communities as well.
Hmm. I wonder if you've had the opportunity to explore much in the way of social media and the way that the typical American, if there's no such thing, I don't know why I even said that, but I mean, the way in which Americans utilize social media when it comes to this sort of matter of tribalism. Because on the one hand, we can see how there does seem to be this deepening divide and people wanting to sort of congregate with people who see the world as they do and the comfort of being in that sort of echo chamber versus something like Facebook, in which if you make certain choices about who your friends are going to be, you can really access the worldview of people who see the world very differently from you. But it just happens to be your cousin or you know, someone who used to be a good friend or whatever. And you know, in a thing like Facebook, you can really experience other worldviews in a way that was very difficult. If you lived
in 140 characters or less.
Right, right.
Which is the problem.
Sure. You know? But I mean, in a way that was, you know, all but impossible 30 years ago, if you lived in a little town in Iowa, you wouldn't necessarily encounter in that kind of way other ways of seeing the world. But if you don't make certain choices with something like Facebook, you could be just as isolated there as anywhere.
Well, there's an age connect. There's an urban-rural divide. Right now in Wisconsin, I've noticed that there's a grant that I think that the state is getting from the federal government to expand internet to rural areas up north. Our cottage, my wife and I have a second home up by on a lakefront home in Lac des Flambeaux, and indeed internet access is still problematic up there. Mm. We were able to get in on a government program where we can stream two Netflix movies and then our monthly quota is gone. But this, see, there is a disconnect but in social media and access to using that.
Mm.
It is based on age. It is based on as well on location, and to some extent on religion. Though I have noticed that many churches now, in the research have started using social media much more effectively. It's very, very important to people in small town and rural churches. And in many of those communities out there, and especially in the Great Plains, as we move west and north of where we are here in Kenosha, social media becomes really the future way of communicating. There are many people in rural areas who are isolated, who are not able to connect with neighbors and friends, and that's true among the elderly as well. So I would look for that, the amount of foot traffic that is listening and using social media to increase in rural areas. But there's a long way to catch up, and social media is not as available in some of the small towns and rural areas. It is becoming increasingly an important mechanism, though, for rural and small-town churches to reach out to the unchurched in their community. The people who come to church, you just do a church bulletin, and they know what's going on Wednesday night, the potluck or whatever it is. But to reach people, there are many people that are sitting out in rural areas that have a hard time forming bonds and community. And I think that the Internet has provided a new opportunity for that. The face-to-face interaction is maybe not going to be the same. But so it's a new way of relating to people. Mm-hmm. How that's going to cross-cut religious culture is at this point difficult to say.
Right. Well, as I suspected, we've spent a lot of time talking about some of these other fascinating things and have taken our sweet old time in getting to one of the main things we were going to talk about. But I do want to spend our last 5 minutes talking about the way in which religion has intersected with this current political race and to what extent religion is any sort of driving factor in who's doing well, who's doing not so well, and the way in which candidates, to whatever extent they are sort of couching what they are saying to, in a sense, I suppose maybe one way to say it, is pandering to those who are very religious and for whom certain religious principles and beliefs are of paramount importance.
Certainly,
what have you seen
yes.
so far?
Yeah, certainly that's the case, Greg. And indeed, some of the pandering is sincere, though. There are examples of politicians who are actually very devout in their faith. I think the overall view is that religion is it's important to reference religion for politicians. I mean, it's just unavoidable. It is normative in our culture. It is a marker of trust in public affairs. Religion is important for social solidarity and national identity. The United States, by all measures, is a far more religious country than in traditional terms, at least, than Europe or other developed countries. Also, religion is a symbolic boundary of tribal inclusion. And because of that, we have to wade through all the buzzwords and code words that are invoking religion. But just a quick rundown of who's who. Bernie Sanders, I made a few notes. Bernie
yeah.
Sanders, Jewish, inactive. However, quasi-atheist, there's some sort of de facto atheism there. Hillary Clinton, some Southern Baptist connections to her husband, but has spent her life as a Methodist, which is a kind of centrist in terms of religion and very involved in social justice activities. And Hillary's a good reflection of that. Donald Trump, nominally Presbyterian, although he's been accused of being Dutch Reformed. In the Reformed world, Dutch Reformed and Presbyterian are almost synonyms. So kind of nominally Presbyterian. Ted Cruz, Southern Baptist, very devout, has really played to the evangelical vote with varying degrees of success in Iowa. Marco Rubio, Roman Catholic, but disagrees with the Pope on a host of issues, spent several years as a child in the Mormon faith. His family went Mormon for a while, yeah. Very interesting. Rubio attends a non-denominational megachurch, I guess covering his bets since the early 2000s. And Ben Carson, Seventh-day Adventist. Seventh-day Adventists believe that the world is imminently going to end, so why get involved in political activity at all? But they do, and that's increasing. John Kasich, I added, was reared Roman Catholic, but his parents were killed in a car accident, and he converted to Episcopalian. Even George Bush grew up Episcopalian and had a profound religious experience when he was recovering from alcohol use, overuse, and so religion plays out for the candidates in major ways, especially on the Republican side. But religion does matter on the Democratic side. Keep in mind, for instance, African Americans tend to be highly religious, and that's 40% of the Democratic vote.
Mm. So, for instance, when it comes to someone like Bernie Sanders, he probably faces a very steep uphill climb with that particular population,
black voters, yeah.
for maybe even more reasons than that, but certainly for that particular reason, that's going to be something that really, in the minds of some at least, shuts him down as a viable candidate.
You have to find a common language and a common bridge. It doesn't have to be exactly the same. I think that somebody like Bernie Sanders can appeal across that divide, but it requires some practice. And in the hot contested primary season, just like with the radio, eventually you're out of time.
Right. Real quick, how would you, I think one thing that has surprised people about Donald Trump's immense success thus far on the Republican side is the fact that we hear so much about conservative evangelicals being such a driving force on the Republican side. And yet, of the major contenders, Donald Trump, by just about any possible measure, is, one would think, the least ostensibly religious person himself. He talks about it very little. And when he talks about it, I mean, when he quotes a Bible verse coming from 2 Corinthians instead of 2 Corinthians, I mean, it's really pretty clear that his own religious life would seem at least to be relatively minimal. And yet he seems to have this immense attractiveness to that population. Do you have some sense of what might be going on there?
Yes. Well, nobody expected, none of the pollsters expected the religious right to something like 30-40%, depending on the state, of the religious Protestant evangelicals have been voting for Trump and supporting Trump. So what's going on there? I think Trump represents the consumerist culture, self-promoting and branding himself. That's, he's in the business of branding himself, putting his brand out there. So between the reality TV host background and the consumerist culture, that is where the resonance is. After all, conservatives are not only influenced by religion, but also influenced by the places where they live, by the kinds of media that they consume. And therefore, religion is not the only factor. Otherwise, you would expect Trump wouldn't be getting very far with that constituency. He's pulling in 35-40% of Protestant evangelicals. Religion is not the only basis upon which they make a decision to vote. Yeah,
and I guess that's a good reminder that we should not be too simplistic in the pronouncements we make about anyone or anything. And that's one of the things that sociologists are quick to remind us of.
Well, sociology is about everything and how everything is connected to everything else. And if that seems confusing, it's a wonderful cornucopia to be involved in that. Yeah.
Well, Professor Wayne Thompson, I'm so glad that you're such an able spokesman on behalf of your academic discipline. And it's been great to have you here on The Morning Show to talk about all of this and more. And I look forward to your future visits to The Morning Show. It's been great to have
pleasure.
You here.
My pleasure, yes.
Thank you for being here. Dr. Wayne Thompson, Associate Professor of Sociology at Carthage College. The Morning Show airs every weekday morning between 8 and 9 o'clock. So